This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
As usual, I want to thank the Pardes Institute, pardes.org.il, for making this class happen. Hi, everybody. Good morning. That announcement about the Pardes Institute? The website... You can ask me questions about website afterwards. I'm not really sure what we're speaking about right now. Okay, I mean, I know what we're speaking about today. I just didn't understand the question. Okay, so we are in the middle of a discussion of the Crusades. And we're going to get into that today. The big picture today is I want to discuss the first and really the second, perhaps even touch the third Crusade, because in many ways for the Jewish story, they are a package. I want to discuss in particular the rise of a very different type of martyrdom than Am Yisrael has known, which will have a deep and lasting effect on Ashkenazi Jewish culture, remembering that we are in the story of Ashkenaz right now. I also want to introduce Rashi as both a personality and as an educational building block in Jewish identity. But in order to do that, I realize I need to pull back the lens a little bit because... some of us have been together for a couple of years at this point. Some people were here last semester. Some people just joined. In fact, it might even be, I don't know if we've met.
You were here last year.
You're here last year. Oh, guys, you guys are on the page. Okay. Okay, but meaning, I'm not sure that we're all speaking the same language. So in order to make sure that we are doing that, I want to revisit very briefly the foundational structure on which I am basing this class. In order that we can focus in on why the Crusades are so formative for Ashkenazi identity, right? And the reality is, if you daven in Ashkenazi shul, you remembered the Crusades last Shabbat, and you'll recall them again this Shabbat, and with the exception of certain joyous occasions, you'll do it every single Shabbat, which is an interesting thing. To think that the Crusades actually play in Ashkenazi culture a constant role when most people don't ever think about them. I know the Holocaust kind of like sort of swept that all under the rug. But so in order to do that, I just want to recall or introduce, depending on where in the class that we are, this fundamental structure of Jewish learning, of the way that the Jewish tradition has taught us to engage text. It's called the Pardes structure. Right? It's not a coincidence, or actually it is a coincidence, but meaning it's worth knowing, right? That the words here refer to a framework which we use to engage text. Pshat means what? Right, well, I'm going to use my definition, which is the surface meaning. Surface not meaning superficial, but surface in terms of point of contact. And this is going to become very important for us when we talk about Rashi today, because Rashi will declare himself to be a pashtan. Lo bati el lefarish et hapshat, says Rashi. I only came to explain the simple meaning of a text, and then once you learn Rashi, you discover perhaps that's not so simple. Remez means what?
Hint.
It means literally a hint, and this is meaning in context.
Okay.
Right? So therefore, aside from the syntactic and grammatical nature of sentences, like what does the word actually mean and how does it serve a role in the sentence structure, there's a narrative context, right? And this, if you, in your learning, you may be familiar with intertextuality. There are fascinating explorations that can be made between, say, Devarim and Isaiah or other places, right? But these are within the context of grounded text, usually within the context of the Hebrew Bible, typically. Right? Emotional subtext, my personal favorite, right? When the people come to the prophet Samuel and say, you're old and your children are no good, we want a king, and Samuel gets all upset, right? And all the biblical commentators can't figure why he's so upset because it's a mitzvah to appoint a king, but you can tell me why he's so upset. Why? Because they just told him he's old and his kids are no good. Anything they ask for after that is a non-starter. I try to teach this to my children when they yell at me and then ask me to drive them to the mall. They haven't figured it out yet. So then we have drash, which literally means what? To seek. And this is meaning in total context. Which is a lot more challenging because if we're going to limit local context to the Hebrew Bible, where does total context reside? Even the outside world is fishy. There's no outside world. That's an abstraction. Right? So anybody here ever study a literary theory? Right? You guys weren't subjected to that in college. You were saved from the postmodern nightmare. I bet you that any of my students from age 35 or younger will tell you that meaning resides in reader and not in text. Right? And this, by the way, this sage is new. This is why if you've ever read Midrash, hence the level of Drash, you've probably had the experience of saying, well, they took that verse totally out of context, right? If you've ever read Midrash, you've had that experience. Right? Well, no, they didn't take it out of context. They took it out of local context, and they elevated it into what the sage is deemed to be its total context. But where does that total context reside? Within the reader. Now, we, because we have a belief in an integrity of tradition and also an authority of knowledge, believe that when the sages do that, there's something genuine about it, as opposed to when perhaps one of my students occasionally does it and I say, not buying it, you know? But at the same time, as my students will often say to me, why can't I create my own midrashim? My answer is you absolutely can. First, you have to master this and this. So if you can't read the Hebrew language and you don't have the entire Bible memorized, so the likelihood that what you're going to say here is going to be a resonant depth is unlikely. It does happen, by the way. I've had incredible observations made by my students in text. It's just that it's much harder because these are emergent layers. Once you have this, then you can speak about this.
I've got a problem with meaning in total context. I've explained it. It doesn't seem to me to add up. It seems to be what you're saying there is that anybody can, that it's all relative. It's not an idea and so on. The authority is not necessarily here or there. It can be in
so. I would say this, without getting into the postmodern debate, which I might out myself as one, is that the difference between the traditional understanding and the postmodern understanding is this a reading out or a reading in? Right? Am I projecting meaning on the text, which actually resides in me, or am I deriving meaning from the text, which only comes to be from my encounter with it? But it's there in the text. The traditional understanding of Torah is that it is a reading out, not a reading in. That once I've mastered the pshat and I've memorized the entire structure of the Hebrew Bible, then when I come to look with this total context, what emerges is genuine, as opposed to it's very gray, and it depends on how. This is, by the way, how we can have different, totally different readings of the Torah. From two, it's like Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Ishmael is probably the best example, giants of Torah who completely disagreed about fundamental ways, as we're going to see today in Rashi's story. So, yes, there is a postmodern problem here. It's a question of authority. Did the sages just have a mastery that we don't have? It's also a question of, is there a meaning which emerges as opposed to one which is projected on the text? You understand the distinctions? These are subtle distinctions, but you are correct.
I mean, the Midrashim, you said a perfect example. I mean, sometimes you couldn't necessarily derive a meaning from the text
and
they are from
the reader. It can be from Greek philosophy, it can be from the person's life experience, absolutely. Which is, by the way, the other question, which we're not going to go into right now, but it's going to matter when we get to the Tosfos, is at what level does authority reside? Let's not lose sight of that, because another part of the post, I'll get you into that, another part of the postmodern question, if people have read Foucault, is the question of power. I mean, it's all well and good to have debates about meaning and text, and blah, but who really cares, frankly, whether the meaning resides in me or the meaning resides in the text? I'll tell you who cares. Who cares is my students when they come to me and say, my brother is getting married in Death Valley on a Shabbos afternoon. This actually happened to me. I think it was his cousin, but Death Valley on a Shabbos afternoon in a place where I can't possibly stay. Can I walk without an Eruv, 5 miles in the summer in Death Valley? Well, what do they want to know? They want to know, what does God think about that? Because I'm going to make a hard values decision about whether I'm going to my cousin's wedding or not. And I want to know, what's the authority that resides in that interpretation? You understand why your question is extremely important. Yeah, but I'm making a polemic there. You're correct. I'm making a polemic that there is a meaning. I am not a believer that. No, I'm holding the markers. we could have this debate, but I don't want to hang up on this because I'm doing it for a reason, aside from the fact that it's important general knowledge, right? Last level here means literally what? secret, right? And a secret, of course, is something you never tell anyone. So this is actually meaning experienced, but not communicated. Yes, because to communicate, we have to share some structure, a language, experience, what have you. This is why if I want to tell you about my inner experience, oftentimes I destroy it in order to communicate it. Right? Because the innerness of my love, right, does not bear words, as the poet struggles to communicate their feelings. Right? So there's a place, and if we think about this, this is of course where Jewish mysticism tends to reside. Mystical systems reside here in the Drush. Mysticism itself, the gnosis, the knowledge of God, resides here, right? And you cannot share that. Now, why am I bringing this? There's much more to be said there. And by the way, if people want, you can send me an email. I have a whole podcast explaining why this matters to Jewish history. But it's going to matter to us because I realize I can't talk about the Tosafos and martyrdom if you don't understand where I'm coming from. So this works in history as well. Right? In my opinion, the Jewish history, as opposed to the history of kings and their wars, which is political history, or economic history, which is an understanding of how sort of, you know, economic relations drive human society, or social history, or et cetera, the best example I can give you is feminist history. Anybody study history in college at any point? What was the great breakthrough of feminist history? Remember, it's not women's history, it's feminist history. Women's history is, here's the subplot of women in history as you know it. What's feminist history? It's a critique of history as you know it through a lens of gender. Saying, oh, you thought you knew what that story was about, but the reality is there's a whole side of the story that's been left out, suppressed, you know, sort of disempowered. And if we reinstall that side of the story changes. It's not a subplot. It's a critical lens. In the same way that sort of black history served the same role in American history, it's a very, very different story of America you get if you ask a young black man age 25, what's the American story, than if you ask a young white man. It's just a reality of life. And so, therefore, I'll never forget, it was ninth grade in my world history class when we were studying the Crusades. I went to public school my whole life. At the end of the lesson, I couldn't help it. I went up to the teacher and I said, well, you know, that was really interesting, but it's not how I heard the story.
Exactly. Yeah, there's another example of that that I've often used, and that's political theory.
Mm-hmm.
Political theory, when you look at the history of ideas, how people are governed, what the nature of man is, and all that kind of stuff, it's derived, basically, without going into a lot of detail, it's very Christian.
It's Greco-Roman, even.
Greco-Roman, and then Christian, and there's not a reference to any of the governance, interpersonal relationship,
Which would be fine if it didn't purport to be a neutral, philosophical approach.
It's just mind-boggling when you step back. When I was studying it as undergraduate, this didn't occur to me.
Right.
When I started studying it as a graduate student, and then even more so coming to Pardes,
So therefore, the Jewish story is not a subplot of history. Certainly not a subplot of European history. What it is a critical lens. And what I would add to it is this, is that, you know, it's a truism that who writes history? Except when it comes to the Jews. That is one of the most important points of datum that you can take with yourself if you want to understand the Jewish story, is that truism, the victors write the history, is actually quite true, except when it comes to the Jews. That the Jews have, so to speak, lost every battle we fought before 1948, right? Lost every battle we've fought for the last 2,000 years, and yet we're still writing the history. And because of that, one second, please, because of that, what we offer is the inner experience of a consciousness that emerges through time, which isn't dependent on the ability to control the external context, but is rather dependent on the ability to control the internal context. So therefore, Jewish history becomes an unfolding of consciousness through time. So that's why the subtitle for this class is Jewish Consciousness in its Historical Context. You guys may have noticed that I veer sometimes alarmingly between a critical historical view and an internal traditional narrative. Right? That's not an accident. What I'm trying to show you guys is how one emerges from the other and how one can inform the other and how one challenges the other. And so therefore, in order to understand where we are at in the area of the Crusades, I want to plug it into here. I don't know your name. Maureen, did you want to say something? Because I asked you stuff. Great, thank you. I appreciate that. No, I'm being serious. No, it's a very, by the way, it's a real skill to have something to say and decide, no, I'm not going to say it. Yeah.
Jewish history, human being, is because of literacy, all these other people. You don't get sort of black history put down.
You are correct. The literacy and both literacy and literary elements are very important. And in many ways, what I would say is that the great blessing of the Jewish people is that we came to consciousness that the world is a story before any other people who are still telling it today. Meaning there may be people who came to that consciousness before us, but they fell out of the narrative, right? And we are still aware that we are telling a story, right? By the way, next time you get stuck in traffic in Jerusalem or the noise of construction is keeping you awake, just remember that our primary story is the rebuilding of Jerusalem. It'll help. Okay, so in terms of history, right, this time period, right, our story has a beginning, and I'm not going to go into it all, but it's important to remember our story does have a beginning, which don't forget, of course, that if you'd walk into any university, we'll give it 100 years at this point. If you walked into any university in the entire world 100 years ago and asked them how old the universe was, they'd have laughed you out as a Bible-thumping fanatic. And now it's just a matter of exactly how old. That's a big win. Right? So let's remember, the story has a beginning. And in this phase of shot of just simply what I like to call a dream time, this is before you even know there's a story, you're just living life as it is, comes right until entry into the land. That under Joshua, right, with Joshua, it's the conquest. And those of you who are familiar with the archaeology and all the questions of historicity, you know that there's a lot of questions there. And there's a lot of ways you can tell that story. Maybe someday we'll get to go to Shiloh together. It's my favorite spot to explore that question. But either way, in my model, it doesn't really matter to me because history as a collection of facts doesn't emerge into human consciousness until much, much later than this, right? Everybody's just telling their story at this point, and most of them don't even know it. Last comment, just because it's worth it, we're done with Bereishit. But when you get back there, just notice that God is constantly poking Abraham to realize that there's a story and it's not just his life. Go back and look at his. It's really, God's really, I'm going to tell you what's going to happen. Abram, not necessarily so interested. All right, the next phase here is the first temple period. This is the phase of adolescence for Am Yisrael, right? It's where we find our voice. This is, of course, where our great literature is rooted in the Bible. Whether you take a biblical critical perspective or whether you take a traditional narrative, right? All the books of the Bible are basically more or less complete. By the time of Return to Zion, right, that's under Ezra and Nehemiah, which is the dividing line. These aren't hard and fast. Remember, periodicity in history is a loose science. These aren't hard and fast. And if people want, we could discuss it at a different time in much more detail if you're interested. But why it matters for me is this. Is at this point, at the beginning of the Second Temple period, a new model of identity emerges. Here, we were adolescents. We lived in our own land. We were absorbed with our own experience. This may come off often. I'm raising teenage daughters right now, right? The hallmark of adolescence is that my identity is completely founded on my selfhood, right? Right? Rightfully so, because in order to figure out who I am, I have to allow myself to be consumed by my ideas. I can't start into the critical self-awareness generated by what will that person think of me? That usually doesn't go well when you're a teenager. Why? Because you don't have a solid enough selfhood. But that leads to a self-absorption. It can be even like, disastrous narcissism. Who knows? If you don't take care of it, one day you could grow up an adult and you could stay that way. But, it's also, by the way, the hallmark of artists. Anybody here an artist? Even not professionally, just passionately, personally? In whatever medium, doesn't matter what medium it is. That in order to create, you have to allow yourself to be consumed by your ideas before you expose them to critical input. Then, okay, I'll put it down on paper, or I'll put it like Alex just shredded. I don't know if those of you heard me, one of the written piece I'd send him. That's fine, in Libya. Like, it wasn't great. I knew it wasn't great. But I had to let myself write it before I could worry about what he was going to think about it. Right? That's adolescence. The next phase of maturity, though, the hallmark is understanding that my identity is in relationship with yours. Right? Empathy is one of the hallmarks of maturity. In our history, the return to Zion came almost hand in hand with what? The Greek encounter. That's really where our story has started since last year. The Greek encounter is the first time Am Yisrael had to think of it, conceive of itself in relationship to other. The Bible, what role do the non-Jews play in the Bible? Right, kill them all. Get them out of the way. Right, there's not much to consider. Until you get to like Isaiah and the later, books of the prophets, where it's like, oh, like to the nations, maybe they actually matter. But certainly in the five books of the Torah, that no, but you see there's an evolution of relationship which comes to a critical point for us now. Because the hallmark of the adolescent is, it's all about me. The nature of relationship in the next phase, in the mature phase, is self in relationship to other. You know what that necessitates? A very clear boundary. Right? Adolescents, the whole world's about them. They don't need any boundaries. A mature person who recognizes the legitimate existence of other actually needs a very clear boundary of self. Just ask yourself if you've ever been in a relationship where you started to lose track of your own boundaries. Did it go well? No, they don't tend to go well, right? And so therefore, in order to both survive and thrive in this time period, notice, seeking a meaning in total context. Here, local context historically is what? It's the land of Israel. It's the first temple period. Here, what's the context? Well, the second temple period is a small drop because we're not going to go there now, but this ends with the expulsion from Spain, which means that most of it is actually in exile. This is the period in which we will go everywhere, see everything, meet everyone, frankly, adopt every language, every religion, every culture. And if we're going to do that successfully, and what success is remains to be seen, but if we're going to do that successfully, we have to say us. And as we've spoken about many times already in this class, that's a very hard thing to do. To maintain selfhood in relationship to other, particularly when that other, like Christianity, as we'll see today, is actually claiming not only to be you, but that you shouldn't exist anymore. Yeah, Duff. We could probably, yeah, what do you think? Yeah, well, I mean, the height, each of these things has their own topography. The height of this is the taking of the whole story of the Avot and the reduction to a, reduction is not the right word, it's the reification to a source code or a DNA, which is the Torah, which can then be manifest throughout time. But I'm giving you a simple approach, and I hope this isn't too overwhelming, because now we have to talk about this boundary maintenance, which is the hallmark. Think about what you know of Judaism. Judaism, as we know it, is a product of this time period. And I promise you, consciously or not, you're all aware that one of the hallmarks of Jewish identity is us and them. And one of the breakdowns that really actually begins with the expulsion from Spain, but which is more familiar to most of us from modernity, is the places where Jews decide that they don't want an identity based on us and them any longer, and yet they're left without any understanding of what an identity could be based on otherwise. You understand? This is why assimilation and emancipation go so quickly hand in hand. It's like, great, I don't want to have to spit on my neighbors anymore and say, Yagayim, right? I'm not interested in a world like that. Wonderful, I support you in that. Now what? Because the next thing you know, your kids are marrying theirs, and you're failing to communicate to them something essential about Torah. Why? Because the way you receive Torah is in a way which is dependent upon keeping very strong barriers between you and everyone around you. You want to overcome that? I support you, but then tell me what it looks like. What does a new model of identity, and this is the central question that Am Yisrael is hung on right now. You know, one of the reasons that the Zionist enterprise succeeded is because it's on a national scale, the same thing the Jews were doing on a personal scale. We put a boundary around our country instead of around our neighborhood or around our household. Now, within that country, we still have all the same debates, but one of the reasons that we have such a dis-ease with 20% of our population, which isn't Jewish, is because it spoils the fun. It's all well and good to be any kind of Jew you want to, as long as everybody around you is also Jewish. Right? But as soon as I'm any kind of Jew I want to, and I break down all those barriers, but the guy next door happens to be Arab, and my daughter marries him, now I'm super upset. Why are you so upset? I thought you were such a free thinker. Well, I mean, not that free. Anyone ever heard this before? Right? So these are major issues. But for our purposes, we're not there yet. We're in the heart of this time period, in perhaps one of the darkest periods of Ashkenazi Jewish history, right? And that will bring us right back to here. Yeah.
I wanted to ask something about, this is a progression you're laying out here.
Yes.
And one can't roll it back exactly.
Not back, but yeah, go ahead. I'll let you finish your question, yeah. The purple doesn't work. Yes, there is a principle of Jewish mystical thinking which is called Sofo Tachav Berosho, right? That Sofo Tachav Berosho, the end is always planted in the beginning. Is that if you really want to push me on it, Zionism is working its way back through because it wants to be grounded back in a reality where we're not talking about anymore. That desire for natural living, if you ever heard the early Zionists, read the early Zionists, like especially Gordon, or Hanam also, but the sort of, that sense of a desire for a natural living, no longer this estranged, alienated self-awareness, which is a hallmark, it's like the Woody Allen Judaism, right? The natural living, right, is a working back through, and I can actually demonstrate in literature how amazingly quickly the Zionist movement recapitulated all these elements and has now been left not knowing what to do with them. Because, you know, if there's a beginning to our story, there's an end to it as well. What's the end? You guys know the end? Yeah. And this is the thing that Zionism is choking on right now. It is the bone in the throat of our country. We're not able to chew, we're not able to swallow, we're not able to spit it out. That's what I meant by the bone in the throat. Right? And there are like segments that decide it's a lie, and there are segments that are completely convinced that we're there, and there are segments that think we should be going left and right and center, you know. But there's very little honest discussion. You realize that in the Israeli political discourse today, one of the biggest insults you can label someone with this is to be Mashiachisti, to be a messianic. In the political discourse today is one of the biggest insults you can throw. When did that happen? From our greatest hope to the worst political insult within the space of 2-3 generations? That's a problem. Anyway, you guys can listen to season 3 of The Jewish Story. I haven't started yet, but I did just publish something about the Messiah, which was a big step out there. Although I didn't think it was so good, but it's out there. If you want, you can check it out on the website. But anyway, for our purposes, locally, what's important for me that you take away is that the hallmark, the organizing principle of the time period that we're at in our discussion is us and them. This idea that in order to have a sound identity, we have to have a clear boundary. And that, by the way, it may sound harsh, but I'm just to remind you that every relationship is based on separation. It's a little counterintuitive, but if you think about it, you'll realize it's true. You don't have a relationship with your foot. It's part of who you are. Right? You have a relationship with other. And so otherness is both the source of all great pain and suffering and evil in the world, and also the source of all relationship, which, by the way, might illuminate for us why God bothered with the whole creation thing in the first place, because before there was creation, there was no other. So the period of time we're at is a period of time in which, in Europe, we are being constructed into the absolute other. This is the period of time I call the making of the Jew. Right? Because the Jew plays a very specific role in European Christian consciousness, and we will adapt consciously and unconsciously to that role. We already spoke about feudalism and the socio-political context where the Jew fits into the agricultural military complex of Europe. We've charted out some of the theological context. Remember Augustine's suffering remnant, that even though the church has replaced the Jews, the Jew must survive for two reasons. One, as proof of the truth of Christian scripture, because they're pulling out Isaiah 53 and waving it around. And the first person to ask is, oh, so Isaiah was Christian? Well, no, really, he was Jewish. Well, who are the Jews? Oh, look, here they are. So the Jews are a living proof to the truth of Christian interpretation of scripture. And it's hard for us to understand that in our era. It depends on which camp of the Christians, but that's one of them. But either way, they need the text, and they need the Jews to prove the text has been carried through time. I mean, it's hard for us to appreciate this, but this is going to become an important part of our story, is that these people really believe that what it says in the text matters. Now, I'm not going to poke on anybody's theology, but I'm willing to bet that most people, even if they think of themselves as Orthodox Jews, do not live in a world in which the details of what it says in Isaiah dictate reality. Whereas in the medieval era, most people do. I mean, they live in a world where there are fairies in the forests and, you know, demons in the well. So the idea that what it says in Isaiah dictates reality is hardly exceptional. I don't want to go into the Messiah right now. It's too tempting a topic, but you can listen to what I have to say about it on thejewishstory.co. I got to stop you, Dov. I appreciate it. It's a good question. By the way, Gershom Scholem's essay, Toward an Understanding of the Messianic Idea in Judaism, addresses your point exactly. And he said, Gershom Scholem was the great thinker of the scholastic thinker of Jewish mysticism, and he wrote most extensively on the question of the role that messianism plays in our culture. So that I highly recommend everything he wrote on the topic. But for us, here we are in medieval Europe. Right? We spoke about this synod of Rabbeinu Gershom, which I argue is the birth of the era of the Rishonim, of the early medieval authorities. Why? Because even though the Gaonim are still hard at work back in Babylon, Rav Hai Gaon doesn't die till 1038, remember? Even though the Gaonim are still hard at work and still claiming to be the living central authority of all of Am Yisrael, nevertheless, here we have an instance where a rabbi in Mainz, in the heartland of the Rhineland, in Ashkenaz, will gather together all the other Ashkenazi rabbis, and they will make fundamental decisions about Ashkenazi Jewish culture. And they will not purport to make those decisions apply to the Jews in Spain or North Africa or in Babel. And because of that, we now no longer have a central authority. You understand? That aside from content, the issue of monogamy, of women's consent in divorce, of not opening letters without people's consent, and making it easier to accept forced converts back into the fold. Aside from those four points of content that we discuss, what really matters for our story is that this is a shift from the Gaonim and a central living authority to local authority. Now remember, the Rishonim, the early medieval authorities, do recognize the central authority, it's just not alive. What is the central authority for the Rishonim? The Gemara. The text itself. Which is why they will write prolific commentaries and analyses, and they will always base their decisions on the Gemara, but they will not presume to apply their decisions to people outside of their, let's say, geographic context, more or less. Right? It's a loose term. Right? When Rabbeinu Gershom does this, it has nothing to do with the Jews of Spain or Babylon. And so therefore, it's a turning point in our story. One which actually came to Spain a little bit earlier, but for our story here. So we left off, questions or comments before we now go back to the actual crusade where we left off last week. Yes, there is still connectivity. There is still connectivity. Hebrew, as opposed to the way in which it's presented in standard Zionist education, was... No. Because this is a taking of authority. Rabbeinu Gershom learned from the Gaonim. I'm sure there were still letters going back and forth. But you know what he didn't do? He didn't say, make a decision for us. He said, we're going to make a decision for ourselves. And as soon as you say that, we... You say to the rabbi, who's this we you're speaking about? And who does he say? Well, Ashkenazi Jewry. You say, who's that? I thought that everybody were all Jews. And he says, no, we're really not. No Jews over there in Spain, they're living a different life.
This is the beginning of the split of the Jews.
listen, as I pointed out to you, just remind you, my daughter's Devar Torah. Some of you haven't heard this, I'll tell you. Anyway, my daughter comes home from Ghana one day, says she wants to give Devar Torah that night. All the joy of a parent, an immigrant parent. She asks for a glass of water, a little bit of oil, and a fork. Right? Sounds dangerous, right? So she starts to stir there at the Friday night table saying, just like oil doesn't mix with water, so too the Jews will never mix with the nations of the world. As I told you guys, right? 30 years of liberal education between my wife and I, gone by gone. But I'm fascinated because as I'm watching, it's true oil doesn't mix with water, but it emulsifies. The oil itself breaks up and turns into globs. And those globs have internal cohesion and what's called hydrophobia. Oh, they're maintaining a boundary. But because of the repeated blows of the fork, that boundary necessitates a turning inward that actually separates the pieces of oil from each other. And this is precisely what begins to happen. Is it the beginning? It's not the beginning. This has been going on for quite some time. But as long as the Gaonim were able to say, okay, everybody who's a Jew, take two steps to the left. And everybody does. And by the way, if you don't take two steps to the left, what does that mean? You're not a Jew, you're a Karaite, right? And we discussed that split. But it means that everybody, it's a definitional, that everybody who's a Jew now take one step back. You know, we can figure out. Whereas when Rabbeinu Gershom says, he doesn't say everybody's a Jew. He says, all the Ashkenazim in the room can't marry another wife. So all the Sfaradim say, well, don't worry, he's not talking to me. Notice that is the beginning. So if there was a fork, what's about to happen is a blender, right? The fork age is still the Rishonim age. Once we get to early modernity, in the age of what's known as the Achronim, the pace of speed of travel and communication, cultural encounter, the rise of scientific knowledge, right? All these things will make that fork into a blender, to the point where Am Yisrael will basically be a salad dressing by the time the Zionist era emerges. People are just sort of like pixelating. You go upstairs, you talk to my students about where's the place for my brand of Judaism. That's the language today. My brand of Judaism.
So it can be reversed.
Well, there's two ways, by the way, to reverse an emulsion. Anyone know what they are?
No.
What do you do?
Eat? No.
One's very simple. What happens when you leave the salad dressing in the fridge? It separates. It's called settling, pun intended. Right? Meaning you let it sit undisturbed for long enough, and it will come back together. That's the Zionist dream. That's the Zionist dream. The secular Zionist dream is you put the Jews all back in one place, and they'll come back together. You know what the problem has been and why there's so much bitterness underlying the Zionist dream right now? Is it hasn't been quiet or peaceful. There's been those repeated blows don't go away. And so there's a lot of bitterness that underlies the secular Zionist dream because it wasn't supposed to be this way. The other one, you know how else you get rid of emulsion? A surfactant that gets rid of, it's worth it to think about, and then we will get to the Crusades. Here are these little globs of oil. Yeah. Now remember, what makes them globs is two things. Internal cohesion, they want to stick to each other, those Jews. And hydrophobia, anything but the goyim. So one thing you can do is you get all those globs together in one place, and you let them settle, and eventually the Sephardim will marry the Ashkenazim, and the Hasidim will also learn with the Mitnagdim, and you know, and they'll be just like one thing again. That takes a lot of time, and a bit of pressure as well. But if you're constantly shaking things up, it won't happen. The other solution is to put some soap. And you know what happens then? It gets rid of the hydrophobia. And so now one of two things happens. If you've ever seen them deal with an oil spill, on the ocean, what do? They spray it with a surfactant. Why? Because the solution to pollution is dilution. If you get rid of the hydrophobia, then the oil will indeed mix with water. Right? Now that's if it's out there in the ocean. If it's in its own land, then it will recombine. That's the messianic vision. in both its senses. There's a messianic vision where Am Yisrael disappears amongst the nations and the whole world is a different place. And there's a messianic vision where we finally have people back in our land with the temple and the restorationist vision. Those are two very different visions, but you'll find them both in the Midrashim. Both of them are this sort of sense that it's not going to work a natural process. What we need is a surfactant. We need something to get us all back together. So keep those in mind, but I want to talk about the Crusades. Can we talk about the Crusades? It's one of my favorite topics, actually, oddly enough. So we have the beginnings of this Rishonim period. Rabbeinu Gershom, when he was alive, he was Me'or HaGola. He was the light of the exile. The great student of Rabbeinu Gershom, nobody knows his name, but the student of his student was Rashi. Now, I'm a little bit in tension here. I think I actually want to talk about the martyrdom before we talk about Rashi, because we were just on the edge of that in class on last week. So I think we'll start there with the Crusades and the impact on identity, and then we'll talk about Rashi, and I think it actually probably makes more sense that way. Okay, so the general historical context there's an ongoing war between Islam and Christianity. It's been going since Islam in the early 7th century was born out of the Arabian Peninsula, pushed its way north into the Byzantine Empire and west into North Africa and what was, the remnants of the Roman Empire, the Western Roman Empire. And that's still going on today. Just remember it when you read the papers. That contest has not been decided yet, right? But a turning point in the Middle Ages happened when the Byzantine Emperor Alexis I sent out a cry for help to the kingdoms of the West, begging for help against the Seljuk Turks. The Turks were originally Central Asian tribes who, like many other Central Asian tribes, made their way from Central Asia right down toward Europe, but they settled around the shores of the Black Sea and are the roots of the modern Turkish, I almost call it a kingdom. We'll call it a country and leave it at that, right? But it was a new pressure on the Byzantine Empire that they felt they couldn't handle, and so they sent out a call for help. And in response, nominally in response, Pope Urban II at the Council of Clement in 1095 preaches the Crusade. I say nominally in response because if you look into the history of the Crusades, there are many other factors greater than simply a response to distressed Christians in the Middle East and a sense of shame that the holy places of Jerusalem are in the hands of the infidel, which is how it was communicated. There were their own problems within Europe, population issues. There's the issue we spoke about last week of primogeniture, about how the nobility were dividing up their lands to their firstborn, and then you end up with all these sort of noble, highborn, chivalrous knights with nothing good to do, which doesn't go well for your social fabric. Right? All those stories that you may have read about chivalry, about knights in armor questing, just think chaos, right? Because by the way, if you haven't read it, like I said it last week, you've got to read Ivanhoe. If you really want a great fictional president, because obviously Sir Walter Scott lived well after the time period, but nevertheless, it's a great presentation. And by the way, he does quite well in showing how the Jew fits, as we'll see in our story, right? And Isaac of York. So, but what matters for the Jewish story is that the Crusade gets off the ground better than anyone could have expected, right? By the time the Crusades last for about 200 years, and within those 200 years, according to most historians, hundreds of thousands of Roman Catholics will what's take the cross. They will decide to go in the various waves toward redeeming the Holy Land from the infidel. They only succeed. The only time the Crusaders conquered Jerusalem is 1099. The truth is, they get it back for 6 months, something toward the end, right? But the real phase of victory in the First Crusade is when the Crusaders conquered Jerusalem in 1099. But for our story, since we're actually interested in Europe, it matters what they do on the way. Because the First Crusade has two elements. One is the nobility who puts together well-organized armies, which means that they're primarily going to get to the Holy Land how? By boat. Right, who therefore are not going to really pass through the heartland of Ashkenaz and the Rhineland. They might pass through, but they have bigger things on their mind. But there's an instant popular response to the preaching of Pope Urban II, right, that 20,000 people, mostly peasants, led by a man called Peter the Hermit, set off in response to this call, walking toward the Holy Land. And they will encounter the Jews well before they ever get there. In fact, most of them don't ever get there. They're ambushed by the Turks. Only about 3,000 people escape. But when they get to the Rhineland, right, where the Jewish communities are what's called the communities of Shum, Speyer, Worms, and Mainz, Shin, Vav, Mem, when they get there, there's a quote attributed to Godfrey of Bouillon, who actually eventually went on to be the first ruler of the Crusader Kingdom of Jerusalem. He says, to go on this journey, he swears only after avenging the blood of the crucified one by shedding Jewish blood and completely eradicating any trace of those bearing the name Jew. Well, here's the thing. As we said, Augustine, the power of Augustine's suffering remnant strategy, if you will, was in the institutions. The institutional church had its own reasons for wanting to protect the Jews. And we know that the kings, the true powers of the feudal nobility, had their own reasons for wanting to protect the Jews. Why? Because you don't kill the goose that laid the golden egg, right? The Jews are the serfs of the king. In the feudal system, they are, in certain sense, his direct property. So therefore, the king can always milk the Jews for taxes. He has access to their capital for loans, right? He's not going to just destroy them. But the nobility in between the church and the king, not to mention the peasantry who have been fed at this point on a healthy mix of superstition and religious Jew hatred, are more than happy to riot. Plus, I mean, let's face it, people are just more than happy to riot in general. Some things never change, right? And so therefore, even though the emperor, Henry IV, that's the Holy Roman Emperor, issued a command prohibiting the destruction of these Jewish communities, he was ignored. Right, and therefore we get what's known as either Churban Shum, right, the destruction of these communities, or the Gezeirah of Tatnu. Tatnu, Taf Taf Nun Vav is the Hebrew year 800. That'd be. I gotta think about it for a second. I think it's 50. I have to do the math right now. Sorry, it's no Tatnu because the 856 is the you gonna work it out? Which is it gonna be 4-8? It's gonna be 4-8. Yeah, it'll be 4. It'll be 4-8. Yeah. 4-8-5-6. 4-8-5-6. That makes sense. So what happens? So as is always true when it comes to history, the question is, what's the documentation? What happens when this mob gets to the Rhineland, to these three communities, right? And the reality is documentation in history is a problem not just in such a tragic case. It's a problem in most cases. The difference is that most of the documentation we have of the days of, and weeks of destruction in Tatnu were written in the 12th century. So they're written approximately 100 years afterwards. Now they may also include, and many historians believe they do include, firsthand accounts, but they also were written largely as religious chronicles and as liturgical poetry. There are three sources. There's what's known as the Hebrew Chronicles, right? They're all together, they're known as the Hebrew Chronicles. There's the writings of Shlomo Bar Shimshon, those of Eliezer Bar Natan, and what's known as Anonymous of Mainz. There's some Jew from Mainz who records it. And again, the core element of these chronicles purports to be a first-hand account, but it's clear that its purpose is theological and not historical. But what comes is horrific stories like the following, right? In the third of Sivan, if people are familiar with the Ashkenazi experience of the Jewish calendar, that it was in the weeks leading up to Shavuot that these tragedies happen, and that's one of the reasons that Sfirat HaOmer, that the counting of the Omer between Pesach and Shavuot, receives such a heavy element of mourning within Ashkenazi tradition. Meaning, as elements of mourning in all traditions, and there are all kinds of reasons, and if you look into the literature, it's often a question, like, why? Why are we mourning in this period? Flat-out historical, sociological reason in Ashkenaz is because this is when the communities of Speyer, Mainz, and Worms were destroyed. Right? So whatever other reasons are sort of projected on that, historically this is what happens. So he says, on the 3rd of Sivan, the first week of May, B'minyanam, the mob approached Mainz, which was the crown jewel of Jewish life in the Rhineland. The community took refuge where? In the bishop's palace. Because, like I said, right, that the organized church had its reasons for protecting the people, and indeed, the from all accounts, the bishop attempted with his own armed men to oppose the mob, but nevertheless, the attack was successful, right? And the question of how many are killed in the decrees of Tatnu is a very big question. Remember, I told you guys there are approximately 20,000 Jews in all of Ashkenaz at this point in history, right? And the numbers range from 2,000 to 12,000. From that's like I got my numbers straight this time. That's from 10% to 50%. No, last time I said from 10% to a third, and I was like, no, that doesn't work, right? 10% to 50%. Now, and they're highly polemical. It seems to me personally that the idea that half the Jews of the Rhineland were killed is a bit far-fetched. Nevertheless, it's not the numbers that matter. It's the stories of the rabbis who kill their congregants, of the mothers who kill their children, of the fathers who say the blessing over ritual slaughter and then slit the knives of their, they slit the throats of their sons. There's a dramatic shift in the behavior of the Jews that happens in both the First and the Second Crusade, something we have not seen in Jewish history since Masada. Meaning, martyrdom is nothing new, sadly. Martyrdom is something that you can trace a line. Certainly, probably the best-known martyrdom is what's called the Asrat Horge Malchut. There are the 10 victims of the kingdom, right, that we recite, at least Ashkenazim and Nusach Sfard recite as part of the liturgy in the Musaf, the additional service on Yom Kippur, right? Which is, it's part of a much larger Midrashic collection called Arze Levanon, if people are familiar with that. Ela Ezkara, those are the names that it's given. We also recite it on the 9th of Av, this list of the 10 rabbis that were tortured to death by Rome. But you'll notice, what's the hallmark of all those rabbis? They were passive martyrs. It's true, some of them courted martyrdom. Some of the things that they did, right, Rabbi Akiva teaching Torah in public, if you're familiar with the Gemara in Brachot, where Papa like, confronts him, what are you doing, or Rabbi Trajan, but none of them took their own life. There seemed to be some indications earlier in the 11th century that such a thing was possible, but we have, and even if the numbers are exaggerated, the phenomenon of people who will kill themselves and their own children and their rabbis killing the congregants is not only reported, but it's lauded. It's celebrated, dare I say, such a thing, in this literature, what are known as the Hebrew Chronicles reporting the First Crusade. And the question we have to ask is, why? Why would such a thing happen? Not only that, but how could it be? First of all, why are they killing themselves? What's their fear? Yes, forcible conversion. That's what's communicated very clearly in the literature, that they killed themselves lest they be forced to convert, because the crusaders were putting them to the question, kiss the cross or take the sword, right? And this will matter. I don't think we're going to really go into Spain in this year because we did it last year, but those of us who were together last year, I pointed out to you that what's happening in Spain right now is fundamentally different, that ultimately the martyrdom which is called for in Spain, one could make a historical judgment that the Jews failed. That the level of conversion as opposed to martyrdom in Spain is fundamentally different. And here you have, in Ashkenaz, between the time of Rabbeinu Gershom, who we said that his son was a convert to Christianity, and not a forced one, maybe under duress, but he never came back. Just ask yourself, what would happen if the chief rabbi of Israel's son converted to Islam? That would be rather shocking. Right? But within 100 years, the students of his students will kill their children and themselves, lest even such a chance occur. What changed? We're going to come to the blood libel. The first recorded blood libel is after this. That's the first recorded. I mean, presumably, there are implications of blood libel much earlier, but this is the first, like, classic story. That's where the story comes from, you're saying? Oh, interesting. I hadn't thought about the connection. We'll talk about it. We'll also talk about it in terms of the rise of the doctrine of transubstantiation. But were we going to add, Duff? most of the incidents are reported. Remember, we don't know whether we're seeing the factual or how they're presented. In my eyes, it doesn't matter for the reason, because these are post-facto accounts. They're a framing of a historical experience for a very specific purpose, right? So let's get at the purpose, and perhaps it'll help us understand the causes. To paganism, right.
I mean, they were just, I mean, to my mind, there's a difference, and Martin used to, there are people who are killed anyway, in their choice.
Sure.
The people at the one you talk about who have a choice and decide to accept death rather than convert.
Yes.
And that, to my mind, is more of a martyr.
Fair enough. There are different elements to martyrdom here. And it deserves to be discussed. But I want to focus on what happened here in the Rhineland, which will become the formative moment of Ashkenazi identity. Now, let's get that straight. Is that Rabbeinu Gershom technically is the beginning of the Rishonim period and therefore Ashkenazi authority separate from the Gaonim. Identity-wise, it will be the Crusades and the experience of the suffering of the Crusades and then the way in which that story is told and built into the liturgy. I want you to picture in the shuls where they would read the roll calls of the martyrs every year. Where the poetry, because the way that they prayed, we spoke about piyutim, the liturgical poetry and the role that it plays in Ashkenazi liturgy. Today, it's like been shrunken. But if you go look in like an old Ashkenazi siddur, you'll find what are called the yotzrot, right? The liturgical poetry, which is inserted into the shmona, sorry, into the mida itself, something which only remnant in Ashkenazi tradition is on the high holidays, when in the midst of the first three blessings of the Shemona Esrei that the Shliach Tzibur will start, you know, into all those, right, Bezod Kenim and all these crazy poetry, there was a tradition to do that on many special days, and in theory, on any given day. And so it would be responsive to a historical reality. It was a wealth. It was built into the liturgy. These martyrs became central to their culture. Why? So number one, Ashkenazi Jewry, all of Jewry, but we're talking about the Ashkenazim right now, has a very big problem. It's a theological problem, which is how could it be that we're the chosen people and we're in such a lowly state? And in particular, that our oppressors are the church who claims to have actually replaced us. Remember, his history seems to be on side of the church right now, right? That Augustine's argument that the Jews should be scattered, right? Slay them not, scatter them lest they forget, right? This is Augustine's interpretation of Psalms. Seems to have been borne out by history. Here are the Jews in a lowly state, subject to the power of feudal Europe, which is a combination of Christian and you know, civil law. There's no distinction there, right? And completely degraded. That's a major problem. And it's not just a theological problem that, you know, rabbis are sitting in rooms trying to figure out some, you know what it is? It's an educational problem. The son of Rabbeinu Gershom joined the other team. Why? Because it looks like they're winning. Mm-hmm. And don't undervalue, you know, last year we spoke about the very sort of well-known letter from a student to a teacher in 14th century Spain. Right? From Rabbi Joshua Lorca, if you remember, wrote a letter to his teacher who converted to Christianity. And he asks him, why'd you do it? And he goes through the possibilities. Maybe suffering in exile was too much. Maybe you just wanted the good life. Maybe philosophy undermined your confidence. And then, like, each one he dismisses. And then he gets to the last one, which is that, well, maybe you saw something in their books that made you think they're right. I want you to appreciate the power of that last one. Because the truth of the matter is the human capacity to endure suffering is, unfortunately, unlimited. And we as Jews know that. And also, the attractions of the good life are very easy to dismiss, at least verbally dismiss, with moral literature and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And frankly, philosophy is a very cold blanket, and certainly in Ashkenaz at this point, has made no inroads, not into Christian or Jewish culture. But suffering is only easy, not easy, suffering is only possible to endure if you have some sense of purpose. If you start to believe, or even wonder, whether actually you're just wrong, Are we just clinging to our ancestral ways out of stubbornness? And when the church tells us that God rejected us and that the proof is that we're scattered and under the boot of feudal Europe, that they're right, could you imagine how corrosive that would be? This is a very big problem. And martyrdom in many ways comes to answer it. Now, how does it do so? Well, let's make the problem worse. Is they also have a sociological problem, which is leadership, right? People do not survive without leadership. Read the newspapers, right? And Rabbeinu Gershom represents the beginning of a new model of leadership, which is the classic model that we're familiar with, rabbinic scholarly leadership. Within Ashkenaz, right, it was not clear to anyone at this point that the rabbis were in charge. Not sociologically, meaning if you have a specific halachic question, legal question, of course you're going to go to the learned person, but you know, money talks, right? And so therefore, we're going to see throughout Ashkenazi history and throughout Jewish history is there will always be a marriage, sometimes literally, but certainly figuratively, between the economic elite and the knowledge elite. But the great merchants of the Jews are the ones who really wield power. But the coming class of leadership is the rabbinic class. However, they are in their infancy at this point. Right? Infancy, I mean, you think Rabbeinu Gershom and Rashi, that's not infancy, that's the greatness. But there's not a widespread recognition that just because someone's a rabbi, they have authority. I know you guys might find that hard to believe. There's a sociological problem, which is that there's not a clear leadership class. So not only do you have a religious problem, which is that Christianity seems to be winning, and all you have to do, don't forget, all you have to do to live a good life is just switch teams. Same God, right? Different rules. And suddenly you go from being the lowest to the highest. Like that. So they got a sociological problem as well with the leadership. And they have a practical problem, like I said, which is to prevent conversion. And martyrdom actually offers a solution to them all. Right? Number one, and this is one of the reasons why it seems that there was a switch between the passive and the active, not just because of the historical circumstance, is that there's a need for an activism here. We're going to take the reins. Not only do I rob the victors of their victory, you didn't kill me, nor did you convert me. We took our own lives. Right? That's a taking of agency. There's also the assertion that a martyr, someone who dies as a martyr, as the Gemara says, the soul goes tachet kisei kavod. It goes straight under the throne of God. Meaning, not only did you not force me to convert, and not only did I rob you of your ability to cause me to suffer, but I am in a higher place than you can ever imagine. Right? And furthermore, I've proved to you, oh, you think that you're showing the kingdom of God on earth? Well, I'll show you that you can take my body, you can't take my soul. That this is the point in Jewish history where the kingdom of God is almost wholly within. Right? The kingdom of God is expressed through the adherence to law. Just think about it. Anybody here ever cross against a red light? I won't make you answer the question, right? But if you were going to not cross against the red light, why would you not do so? There's two reasons. Safety and a fear of punishment, right? Meaning there's some sense of malchut. There's some sense of who's in charge here. Now, you might be willing to bend the rules here or there. Now, just imagine the power in 11th century Europe. The Christians don't care whether you light fire to heat your food on Shabbat. On the contrary, they'd love you to do it, right? You don't have prophets or miracles that are indicating that God's displeasure and wrath. Nobody's afraid that a lightning bolt, well, I don't know if nobody, but nobody has seen a lightning bolt recently dropping from the sky when you stirred the coals. Have you ever learned in Hilchot Shabbat when you just just heat it up a little bit, right? I mean, it is, after all, you know, Germany in February, right? Nobody's watching, except, of course, God's watching. And therefore, you are a product of a culture which has adapted your identity to law. Remember I told you this was the rabbinic project. It says a one-to-one identification between law and identity, which means that the kingdom of God exists everywhere. You're walking in the kingdom of God. You think about which shoe you put on first in the morning. You think about what you put in your mouth. You think about what comes out of it. You think about who you'll marry. You think about who you'll touch. You think about everything, everything, everything. And then along comes this crusader and says, I represent the kingdom of God. And you know what you say? No, you don't. This is nonsense. We live outside of that type of history. Martyrdom becomes the ultimate assertion, as it has always been, by the way, that the kingdom of God is not subject to the kingdom of flesh and blood. By the way, who else used that as a founding message for their religion? The Christians. That was a founding, and we're not going to go into it now, but it's quite noteworthy that the Aseret Harge Malchut, the 10 victims of Rome, have a rather strong historical parallel with the Christians that were fed to the lions. But here, you've defeated the Crusaders physically by taking your own life. You've defeated them spiritually by rising to the highest place in heaven. You've defeated them also by asserting that their kingdom is immaterial in the face of the true kingdom of God. And last but certainly not least, you have put forward a heroic model. Because remember, martyrdom is a very bad long-term strategy for people as a whole, right? But it's a very powerful long-term strategy for a small elite. Because the truth of the matter is, as much as, sometimes, I remember there was a relationship class here a while ago that my students told me about, and I got a very interesting comment from one of them who said, we were discussing, you want to marry somebody who has real values. So there was a question that came up, what would you be willing to die for? That's like a way to clarify your values, right? Except the reality is that most of Ashkenaz is not going to be forced to die for what they believe in. But you know what they are going to be forced to do? Live for it. Which one really is the greater act? That moment of self-sacrifice there in the church, in the synagogue, where you hear them coming, you see the torches, you hear the clash of mail, and you have one moment right now to decide who's going to take your life. That's an incredible thing. But how about waking up every single morning and deciding, I will eat that, I won't eat that? How about hacking a hole in the ice of a frozen river in order to get in the mikveh? How about, stopping on your way home on Shabbat when the sun sets and simply sitting in a clearing in the forest, afraid and alone, but knowing that you can't go any further. Not for 1 year, not for 10, for hundreds. Hundreds of years. And yes, there will be people who don't stick to it, and there will be people that sacrifice. But the reality is, we're sitting here having this conversation. Not that everyone here is necessarily Ashkenazi, but the Ashkenazim in this room are sitting here having this conversation because of an absolute determination of a large group of people to live for what they believe in. And the heroic model that the martyrs offer, which is if these holy people were willing to die for it, at least I can live for it. At least I can get up and go to shul. At least I can learn. At least this becomes a powerful organizing principle in Ashkenazi culture, which is why then in shul, you're going to hear about these martyrs. We're going to read their names every Shabbos that they died. We're going to sing liturgical poetry. This is why Ashkenazim to this very day are still saying Ava Rachamim. If you're familiar with the Ashkenazi liturgy, every Shabbat, before the Torah is put away, we're going to recall these holy communities. Those holy communities, by the way, are Speyer's, Worms, and Mainz. That's exactly what they're speaking about. So first of all, I do not answer questions about the what if. I think it's a mistake because we can't know. Number one. Number two, I think you're what you're really saying is what was with this generation that they did. It's hard to imagine. Last thing I would point out is that as I think that the Holocaust showed that there is actually a much deeper adherence to these principles amongst Jews than we often give credit to. It's hard to judge what any of us would do in the worst of times. When we live it now. So, but the question that I hear, which is relevant to our discussion, is that what was this generation that it was capable of such action? Right? And this is one of the great questions, by the way, that nobody has a good answer to, but we know that it perceived itself as unique. That if you look, that in many ways, martyrdom is an answer to, the most fundamental fear that these Jews had, which is that is history broken? Right? We have a driving principle of mipnei chataenu galina me'artzenu. Because of our sins, we were exiled from our lands. Right? We say this in the festival Musaf in the festival additional service. It's a very important phrase, and as I've said to you guys many times, today that sort of rings of Jewish guilt. Because of our sins, we were exiled from our land, right? Meaning today we're suffering for the sins of the past. And there is something to be said in that understanding, and but it's a much later development. Originally, it's an assertion of historical agency. Because if because of our sins we were exiled from our land, that means that no matter, we don't have all the normal tools of historical agency. We don't have a government, we don't have an army, we don't even have a land. But you know what we have? Our actions. Because of our sins we were exiled from our land, because of our merits we will go back. And it's a way to maintain agency even in the darkest and most disempowered periods of Jewish history. The problem is it gets to a point where the punishment appears discontinuity. Discontinuous, that's what I was looking for. Right? At what point do you say, okay, this is too much? And you feel that there's been a break, a theological breakdown, a disruption of history. And this is where martyrdom becomes extremely important here, because you know why? For the very simple reason is that this tragedy allows us to connect to a continuity of Jewish history and not to its discontinuity. Because you know how they saw themselves? As an extension of the generation of the Second Temple. The Midrashim have all kinds of stories, aside from Rabbi Akiva, people might be familiar, and you see them, by the way, on Tisha B'Av, and especially the Ashkenazim in the room who were there in Shul on Tisha B'Av. Just ask yourself this year, who chose which piyutim, which liturgical poems that we're reading right now, and why? Right? And when you read the poems about the 400 young men who threw themselves into the sea, rather than being thrown into slavery, or the 80 Kohanim who went up on the top of the burning temple and chose to die, or the two children, right, the brother and sister, who embrace and seemingly kill themselves. You start noticing a theme, right? That there's a sense that the generation of the Second Temple was spiritually fit to sacrifice itself, and the generation of Ashkenaz in the First Crusades was spiritually fit as well. There's a sense of uniqueness that allows them to leap over the discontinuity and say, oh, well, actually, this is Jewish history. Right? Tragedy, martyrdom, rebirth becomes a continuity that can actually be built on what appears to be the discontinuous. You understand? Seems like a total breakdown. Except when you realize that this has happened before, but the proper response is martyrdom. You can't just endure it. You have to do something about it. That's the only way you can make that bridge. And the great fear, unconscious for most people, but the great fear is to suddenly wake up one morning and realize, where are we right now? Remember the discussion about Ashkenaz and the mythic topography? Nobody in this story wants to wake up and look out their window and say, I'm in the Black Forest, and those are Germans. They must be in Ashkenaz, and they have to be the B'nai Esav. Why? Because that keeps a continuity to the story, which gives meaning to the suffering and allows for a successful strategy moving forward. This is what I mean when I say it is this moment that Ashkenazi identity locks in as a separate Jewish identity. It's when the smile goes out of Ashkenaz. And one more second. And the other thing I want to remind you guys that I pointed out, that we said that Ashkenazi culture derives a lot of its roots from Eretz Yisrael, as opposed to the Babylonian culture, even though by the time the 13th century rolls around, the Babylonian Talmud has swept in and basically kind of like bulldozed everything else. But classic early Ashkenazi culture is rooted particularly in the Midrash, in this sort of Midrashic vision of mythic archetypes. You know, the best way to actually communicate it is to make the comparison to what's happening in Spain at this point. Here it is. I knew it was here somewhere. You know, that the Spanish Jewry is moving toward philosophical rationalism. Right? And there are all kinds of consequences of that in how their history will play itself out in the next few hundred years. Right? But the Jews of Germany and northern France are living a fundamentally different life. Their whole world becomes internally referential. And they make no distinction between the legal, halachic elements of the Gemara and the agadic, the midrashic, the narrative elements. Right? They live within their own story. Right? And therefore, it is perfectly consistent when evil rears its head that they take agency within their story and actually win through self-martyrdom. And they're able to draw out from the Midrash, not from the Halacha. The Halacha looks very askance at taking your own life. And, you know, the great halachicist, he's got another 50, 100 years till he's going to come online, but the Rambam, right, classic halachic mind, what does he say about self-martyrdom? He's very specific about it. Rambam wrote extensively, not just in the Mishnah Torah and his halachic work, but he has what's called Igeret HaShmad, is a letter about martyrdom, right? What he says is that there are very specific circumstances in which one is required to die rather than transgress. And if one chooses to die in any other circumstance, then their blood is on their own head. You become a self-murderer. There's a very limited place for it. On the other hand, if you look at the Tosfos, who are going to emerge out of this culture, they'll tell you that there is such a thing as a midat chasidut. There's exemplary behavior. Choosing to die can actually be a laudatory, what's called lifnim mishurat adin. And you see, there's actual parallels in the way they discuss the idea of what holiness is in the world. For the Tosafists, holiness is a potential which can constantly be expanded. Right? You don't know if you've ever read the Ramban on Kedoshim Tiyud. The Ramban says basically, right, the Torah couldn't possibly tell you everything that you would need to do in your relationship with God. It's not possible to write it all down. Therefore, the Torah gives you all the commandments in order to make you the type of person who's going to know the right thing to do. Meaning that holiness is an ever-expanding area. And when we get further into the Tosafist culture, we'll talk about it. Whereas the Rambam has very clear, holiness is adherence to the will of God, as it says in the Torah, which is why the Rambam produces a legal code, which he really believed was the end. That's it. Here you go. Take my book in the Bible. That's all you'll ever need to know. And the Tosafists create an ever-expanding universe of discourse. So therefore, in their world, there's room to ask the question, what does God want from me right now? Even though legally speaking, I can't do this, it still might be the right thing to do. So this is the roots of the culture out of which such an awe-inspiring and awful decision could possibly be made. There was a question there, yeah? Yes.
Because if these people are willing to die for it, then the least I can do is
eat kosher, and by the way, we've seen the breakdown of that perspective in modernity. I can't speak for your guys' Jewish education, but my Jewish education largely consisted of 6 million people died, marry a Jew. It was a little bit more than that. It's an exaggeration. But I know plenty of people from that was really it. And you know what happened for most of them? Eh. number one, who wants to think about that? Number two, it just sounds racist to your average young American Jew, right? But before that, you're absolutely right. So I said, this is the heroic leadership model, and this will become the organizing principle of Ashkenazi Jewry. It will produce the culture of the Tosafists, which we'll speak about next week. And what I really want to do next is just introduce Rashi into our story. But before I do, other questions or comments on the martyrdom? I can talk about martyrdom all day, unfortunately. I think it's because I'm really, really am Ashkenazi. Problematic, at best.
But the rabbis were just ignoring that?
They weren't just ignoring it. The seems that the culture, the rabbinic culture and the popular culture that acts of self-martyrdom emerge from was one in which if you have the halacha, which is, I wouldn't say cut and dry, but is legal, structural, then you have the agarata. And this is, by the way, a fundamental problem in the relationship with the Gemara. With all these stories, in the Gemara, and sometimes the stories don't fit the law. So there's a constant question that comes up. It's actually come up a number of times in our class. Those of you guys who have been around for a while, is at what point do you break the rules to keep the story going? Right? This is something the Gemara calls Eit Lasot Lashem, Hefiru Et Torah Techa. It's a line in Tehillim that says it's a time to act for God. They have nullified your Torah. But the sages read the second half of the verse as it's a time for act for God by nullifying your Torah. It's just a reality that occasionally history presents you with situations in which a strict adherence to the law would involve a complete abdication of the story. This is the root of the permission that's given to violate Shabbat to save a life. Right? We violate one Shabbat in order to keep many. So one piece is the story allows you to get past the technical, but the other piece is that there's an overarching sense that that this is not a technical legal discussion, but there's actually almost a cosmic battle. There's the mythic thinking, right, between Esav and Yaakov that's going on here, and by taking our lives, we're winning, not losing. So that's a great question. They actually did know about Masada. I mentioned that one of the other pieces of evidence that we have that early Ashkenazi culture was heavily influenced by the land of Israel is the Sefer Yosifun. Sefer Yosifun is an adaption of Josephus, which appears for the first time around, I think it was the 10th century I saw. It was carried by Italian Jewish culture into Ashkenaz, as we spoke about, that it was originally the Italian Jewish culture that crossed the Alps under the invitation from Pepin the Short and Charlemagne. And Sefer Yosifun glorifies the story of the martyrs of Masada. Elazar ben Yair, who was the leader of the zealots that took Masada, is presented as a hero. And there are a number of historians who really believe that now it's hard to, you think about one book, what difference does it make? First of all, don't undervalue the impact of one book. We're Jews. Second of all, it wasn't like everybody had some big bookshelf, right? And the power of story here is a very important piece, right? And the knowledge of Masada fades not too long after this time period. Sefer Yosifun is around, but it doesn't have the same impact because the works of Josephus himself were lost. But Sefer Yosifun plays, according to some historians, a very important role in this whole dynamic, in the decision that was made here. The use of Masada in the modern Zionist narrative is something we could speak about at length. Interestingly enough, though, if you look, the Zionist narrative is what phrase? Masada lo yipol shuv, right? That Masada will never fall again. It's not a martyrdom ideology. It's an empowerment ideology. We'll never let that happen again. Although I think it's got both sides, because what's called the Masada complex is this, there's something in there too. We got to talk about Rashi. We're not gonna get all Rashi today, obviously. But I do want to place him at least in the historical context, because as you can see here, from Rashi's lifetime, from 1040 to 1105, that Rashi's life spans the First Crusade. And one of the big questions, which we'll I guess address next week, is. Historians are not sure when Rashi's great commentary on the Chumash, on the Bible, was written. Was it written before the Crusades or after? It's interesting to me that there's a bit debates about this. I would assume that at this point that you'd be able to tell from internal evidence, but apparently not. But let me give just a few details, and then I'll pose the sort of primary question, and I guess we'll have to answer it next week. So anyway, Rashi, his name is, of course, he wasn't born as Rashi. Shlomo Bar Yitzchak wasn't even born a rabbi. He was just Shlomo, right? Shlomo Bar Yitzchak was born in 1040 in a city called Troyes, written in English, or Troyes in northern France. He dies in the same place. In his life, he claimed that Rabbeinu Gershom was the sort of great teacher of Ashkenazi Jewry. Right, and today, of course, we can't learn the Gemara or, frankly, the Chumash, really, without Rashi. So Rashi becomes, Rashi really literally means Rabbi Shlomo Bar Yitzchak, Reishin Yud, but it's also known Rabban Shel Yisrael is one of the things. Right? The rabbi, the teacher of all of Am Yisrael. And one of the questions that we're going to have to address is that, well, there's two. What was Rashi's mission? What was he after in his commentary on the Chumash in particular? Right, and how did it become so successful? just to appreciate, first of all, Rashi's commentary on the Torah is the first Hebrew book ever printed. There's a debate amongst the historians, either in Rome in 1469 or in Reggio in 1475, but it is the first Hebrew book printed, which is noteworthy. The legend of his birth is, you know, that his father once, in order to deny benefit to a non-Jew, he was going to be robbed, and he threw some valuable jewel into the sea, right? And then he heard a mysterious voice, a bat kol, which foretold the birth of a noble son. I'm not really interested in whether the legend is true, but there's a very important piece in there you can hear in the same martyrdom piece, which is that if I can't have it, then no one will. The last thing that the Jews of this generation wanted was that the non-Jews should benefit from their riches, be it their children, right? They should take them and convert them, right? Or their actual physical wealth. So he was a student of the yeshiva in Mainz and in Worms, which really those central communities of what we called Kilat Shum, right? And in approximately 1065, 1070, Rashi returns to Tual to establish his own yeshiva, right? And that's where, just to give you some context, Rashi famously has no sons. He has three daughters, right? His daughters marry what become the next generation teachers who are known as the Tosafists. Right, there's a whole school who are, some of them are actually genetically descendants of Rashi, and some of them are just intellectually descendants of him, right? But that Rashi begins a process of a creation of the Torah of Ashkenaz. And so the classic question when I say what was Rashi's goal, when you open up the Chumash today and you see Rashi, like some people, like myself included, have a daily practice of reading Rashi on the Chumash. What is Rashi trying to do? So you already gave the answer. What was it, Avram? So Rashi says, this is a famous statement in Perek Gimel. He says it in a few places, but Perek Gimel, Pasuk Chet in Breishit, Rashi says, Ani lo vati ela lepshuto shel mikra. I only came to give you the pshat. Right? And here's the kicker, though. Right? Ula agada hamiyashevet divrei mikra. Davar dibur al ufnav. And that second phrase is the source of more ink. And to tell you the agarata, like the narrative, the midrash, which settles the words of the text, davar dibur al ufnav. Each statement in its, let's say, proper fashion, which is so enigmatic, it's unreal. Right? Because here in Rashi, when you read Rashi, and most people are taught Rashi is a pashtan. He's trying to explain the plain meaning of the text, leaving aside the postmodern problem that such a thing doesn't exist. He's just trying to tell you what it says. The problem with that is, you know, when the daughter of Pharaoh goes down to the river to bathe in the waters, as we say, and she hears the baby crying, and she sees the thing there, and she sends her Amma to go get it. What's the simple meaning of Amma in that verse? It seems to be maidservant. But what does Rashi say? He says two things. He says maidservant, then he says that her arm, like Inspector Gadget, if you ever watched that cartoon, like, extends 10 amot and grabs the basket. Or that Moshe was 10 amot high. Or many other comments from Rashi, which lead to a choice of either mockery or fundamentalism. Meaning I can say, come on, her arm did not extend 10 amot. Rashi said it did. Ergo, Rashi is wrong. This guy, he was so medieval. Right? Or I could take a fundamentalist stance, which, well, that's what Rashi said, so that's how it must have happened. You understand? I think that both of them derive from a deep misunderstanding of what it was he was trying to do. Right? Why is it that Rashi will consistently bring Midrashim to explain what he feels to be the simple meaning of the text? And that's a question, actually, we're going to have to wait until next week to answer. I told you I was going to pose the question, I wasn't going to answer it. That's it. They all come back now, you hear?
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.